Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
My name is Marty Esplin. I'm not Fred, who was supposed to chair the session, but he has been very involved today helping our son with his Eagle project, so I'm here. I'd like to introduce our two speakers. Lou Minch is a psychiatrist in private practice at the Salt Lake Clinic. He has published an article in Sunstone entitled Perceptions of Life, Comedy, Irony, Tragedy, and Romance. And in Mormon Counselors and Psychotherapists, he has published an article called Mormon Forms of Psychopathology. He is married to Debbie, who is a Suzuki violin teacher, and he says a very tolerant widow. And that she really respects the way his mind works. Mark Gustafson has practiced law for 9 years. He is also involved in the management of the Gustafson Group, Incorporated, an interstate construction management corporation. On a personal note, Mark was also responsible for setting up a medical trust fund for a very, very dear friend of mine who has a brain tumor. Mark restores antique cars, writes poetry, and will have an article in the spring issue of Dialogue. He is married to Janet Daly, and they have 3 children. I'll turn the time over now to Lou, who will speak, and then Mark will comment. And if we have time, we will certainly entertain questions from the floor. Thank you.
I didn't actually say Debbie respects how my mind works. I said she tolerates how it's wired. In fairness, I feel compelled to tell you that the debate is over. It's been going on all through history and culminated this week at KSL Television, where Mark and Blake Osler and I debated this issue. And I would like to tell you the outcome of the debate. This was on KSL on the Talk About program, and we were to have a studio audience from the Orem 54th Ward, but the bus didn't show up. And so the producer collared a bunch of visitors through the TV center, and it happened to be a pack of Cub Scouts. So we debated the topic biogenetic determinism and free will in front of these Cub Scouts. And I guess the Orem 54th Ward didn't show up because the topic was intimidating and wasn't in the lesson manual. But the Cub Scouts were gratified, at least those who were working on arrow points in neurophysiology and in the ethical motivational traditions of Western thought. The outcome of the debate seemed to be that the Den Mothers thought the Cub Scouts had entirely too much free will, and the Cub Scouts thought their behavior was overdetermined by the producer, and all things considered, they'd have rather watched professional wrestling. My family and I had a vacation this summer at the Point Reyes National Seashore in Northern California. At the ranger station there is a museum, and there's an exhibit of the various kinds of plant life that grow along the shore in the estuary there. And the ranger had a fascinating explanation for what was in the museum. He said that the different kinds of plants grow where they do because they can't grow anywhere else. And the thought occurred to me, does that only occur with plants, or is that true with humans too? We are the way we are because we can't be any way else. Bridget and Dorothy are 39-year-old British housewives, identical twins who were separated as infants and raised in quite different socioeconomic settings. When they first met each other as adults, the manicured hands of each bore 7 rings. Each also wore 2 bracelets on one wrist and a watch and a bracelet on the other. They discovered they had named their sons Richard Andrew and Andrew Richard, respectively, and their daughters Catherine Louise and Karen Louise. They shared striking similarities in many other areas of their lives. Jim Lewis and Jim Springer, identical twins, were separated 4 weeks after birth in 1940. They grew up 45 miles apart and were reunited in 1979. Both liked math and did not like spelling in school. Both had law enforcement training and worked part-time as deputy sheriffs. Both vacationed in Florida, often at the same 3-block strip of beach. Both drove the same model blue Chevrolet, chain-smoked Salems, and had dogs named Toy. Both married and divorced women named Linda, and had second marriages with women named Betty. They both named their sons James Allen. Both like mechanical drawing and carpentry. They have strikingly similar medical histories. In addition to hemorrhoids, an identical pulse, blood pressure, and sleep patterns, both had inexplicably put on 10 pounds at the same time in their lives. Both suffer from combination tension and migraine headache syndrome, onset in each at age 18, occurring in the late afternoon with the same frequency and degree of disability. Each uses the same terms to describe the pain. Oscar Stuhr and Jack Ufa, 47-year-old identical twins, were born in Trinidad of a Jewish father and a German mother. They were separated shortly after birth, the mother taking Oscar back to Germany, where he was raised as a Catholic and a Nazi youth by his grandmother. Jack was raised in the Caribbean as a Jew by his father and spent part of his youth on an Israeli kibbutz. The two men now lead markedly different lives, yet when they were reunited for the first time since infancy, both were wearing wire-rimmed glasses and mustaches, both sported two-pocket shirts with epaulettes. Both liked spicy foods and sweet liqueurs. Both were absent-minded, have a habit of falling asleep in front of the television, flush the toilet before using it, store rubber bands on their wrists, read magazines from back to front, and dip buttered toast in their coffee. Oscar is domineering toward women and yells at his wife. Jack did so before his wife left him. Though Oscar was raised by women and Jack by men, their mannerisms and temperament were strikingly similar. Two 57-year-old identical twins reared in separate households became diabetic at the same time in their lives. Other pairs of separated twins developed pancreatitis at the same time, others heart attacks, others glaucoma, and others even began wearing eyeglasses in the same year of their lives. Two separated twins raised in very different emotional environments showed very similar neurotic and hypochondriacal traits. The first meeting of these identical twins after their separation in infancy was arranged by Thomas Bouchard at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Bouchard, a psychologist, wanted to find out how the environment works in influencing psychological traits. The most tantalizing of his findings are those that reveal not environmental but genetic influences at work. The study now includes 77 pairs of identical twins brought up apart. The conclusion of this research is that the degree of genetic influence on personality is about 50%. It ranges from a high of 61% in social potency, that is, a tendency toward leadership and dominance, to a low of 33% in social closeness, that is, a need for intimacy and comfort and help. Impulsiveness, aggressiveness, need for achievement, reaction to stress, sense of well-being, alienation, and proneness to imaginative activities all appear hereditary to a substantial degree. Traditionalism, that is, respect for authority, rules, standards, and high morals, all things that characterize what is usually considered a good Latter-day Saint, is 60% inherited. This information shoves the pendulum further away from radical environmentalism, the belief that personalities of children are created by parenting and environment. The mechanism for change, it's true, is laid down at the moment a child is conceived, but the genes provide a rough sketch of his life. While these conclusions leave 50% of our being to determination of environment, all of us make our own environment. The environment molds our personality, but our genes determine what kind of environment we seek. The similarities in illness factors and physiological traits even extend to the electroencephalographs of identical twins, suggesting that wiring diagrams of our brains are genetically determined. Intelligence, for example, is largely under hereditary influence. An outgrowth of this finding is intellectual elitism. The Nobel Prize winner sperm bank is an example. However, says a Nobel Prize winner in genetics who did not donate to the bank, genes may directly control personality, and therefore the progeny of Nobel laureates would be the equivalent of Nobel laureates, which would be awful. Who would want a world populated by such people? There is, of course, no guarantee that high IQ creates better societies. The director of the Hastings Institute observes, it's not the retarded kids of the world who produce the wars and destruction. If breeding can be arranged for intelligence, what about any other kind of trait we might pick? Animal lovers know that dogs can be bred for a wide variety of traits, such as aggression, docility, vigilance, or obedience. What if humans were bred for the distinctive traits a certain culture might admire, such as aggression, docility, obedience, or industry, or agility with a slam dunk? Could we move faster toward utopia? It was tried not long ago, the desired traits being blonde hair, blue eyes, and fair skin, Aryan traits. The fact is, selective breeding of humans goes on constantly. We call it assortive mating, where certain traits, usually ones held in common, attract men and women with stars in their eyes to each other. Tall men attract tall women and marry and have even taller children. Alcoholic men attract women from alcoholic families and perpetuate alcoholism. Dysfunctional people pair with dysfunctional people, either by choice or by default. What opportunities are available to a child with genes for dysfunction raised by two dysfunctional parents? How free are we to choose? What is within our power and what is not? Does anything have to happen? Does everything have to happen? Given the same conditions, could we have been or done otherwise? Is freedom just a name for our ignorance of hidden causes? If so, is there any meaning to the terms values, ethics, or morality? Only chosen behavior can be moral or immoral. What are the underpinnings of the most extraordinary behavior that we see? What about the extraordinary behavior that comes to the psychiatrist's attention? What if antisocial personality is an illness? What if double-binding mothers and schizophrenic sons are mere coincidence? What if homosexuality is a failure of fetal androgen? What if manic or histrionic disorders enhance creativity? What if obedience is in the genes? People's theories about the causal agents of their behavior may range from the extremes of conviction that I am guilty of everything and then some, to don't blame me, it's not my fault, from that's just how I intended it, to the devil of one's choice made me do it. People have theories about the nature of their motivation, from all my actions show my goodness, to even my most innocent thoughts show my murderous intent. People have theories about the sources of their behavior, from no wonder I'm this way, look at the way I was raised, to only bad fate could explain my life. In the science of the mind, we find the same range of attribution of behavior, from 0 to 100% predetermined, depending on the theory. Freud emphasized the unconscious mind as the motivator, and for a long time the psychodynamic school reigned. His original idea was that the mind ran on the principles of fluid hydraulics. Psychic forces made up of drives, instincts, and primitive wishes pushed to the surface of consciousness and expression only to be modified in socially appropriate ways or repressed because of their unacceptability. If repressed, these forces must find another way out, a detour, which is maladaptive and the basis of psychiatric illness. Watson and Skinner have emphasized learning as the motivation to be either the learning by classical conditioning, that is, behavior maintained by its antecedents, such as Pavlov's dog salivating at the sound of a bell, or operant conditioning, that is, behavior maintained by its consequences, such as the star on the forehead for sitting with arms folded in Sunday school. Watson boasted, "Give me a dozen healthy infants, well-formed, and my own specified world to bring them up in, and I will guarantee to take anyone at random and train him to be any type of specialist I might, doctor, lawyer, artist, merchant, even beggar man and thief." Psychodynamic and behavioral psychology both have a more modern competitor, humanistic psychology, which is the third major school of psychological thought and the spawner of myriad pop theories from Gestalt to Rolfing to encounter grouping, tends to assert that man is totally responsible for his choices and his world. Proponents are fond of saying, based on results, what happened is exactly what you wanted to have happen, from failing math to divorce to obesity to needing eyeglasses. All human beings weave their experience and their capacities into some consistent way of understanding themselves and their world and create a theory that provides some degree of comfort, the myth of their lives. At high levels, these theories become philosophies and religions. The individual acts to maximize pleasure and safety and to avoid pain and danger. Or in layman's terms, man is motivated by a will to pleasure. This is the religion espoused by Sigmund Freud. Is this the equivalent of another phrasing, man is that he might have joy? A religion says, know this, that every man is free to choose his life and what he'll be. This suggests we can motivate ourselves by a will to meaning, choosing something that will bring purpose to our lives. How free are we to choose? The answer may be, as free as our minds are to conceive of purposeful thoughts. Obviously, a damaged brain gives one limited freedom. What about a limited brain? Our brains are mechanical structures and structured largely according to the blueprint in the genes. Therefore, our search will be limited to only those thoughts, feelings, and acts of the oceanic possibilities that our individual brains are capable of, that is, wired for. Trying to understand what takes place in the brain to produce behavior is difficult, partly because of the enormity of the numbers of neurons and their wide array of specialized functions, and partly because the brain is completely enclosed in a bony shell, where it's poorly accessible to probing. Seymour Keddy used this analogy. Suppose our civilization is destroyed, and 1,000 years later, extraterrestrial visitors arrive at our planet to find the one remnant of our society, a book. The anatomist would carefully measure the dimensions of the paper and the cover. The physiologist would note that the pages are fastened only on one side and could be turned serially. The biochemist would analyze the content of the glue and of the ink. The sociologist would count the number of times the word the appeared and note with amazement that if the book were turned upside down, the number of the's was the same. From this data, they would arrive at their conclusions as to the meaning of the book and the nature of the society that produced it. We try to decipher the brain's processes by such crude methods as the lumbar puncture or the spinal tap to measure metabolic remnants of chemicals that bathe its surfaces, or by analyzing metabolites in the urine. This is something akin to trying to appreciate the cultural life in the Palace of Versailles by examining the content of the sewers of Paris. In the last 12 years, our ability to look into the brain has enormously been enhanced. The computerized tomography scanner and magnetic resonance imager allow us to see the structures of the brain in astounding detail, all the way from the corpus callosum, the bridge that joins left and right hemispheres and is 40% larger in women than men, with all that theologically implies, to the pineal body, which Middle Ages anatomists and myself conclude must be the seat of the soul. We have the beam scanner, a computerized electroencephalograph that developers say can differentiate by squiggly line analysis the 7 different kinds of depression. We have the PET scanner that tells which part of the brain is active or inactive in various states of mental function or dysfunction by measuring where the brain's fuel is consumed. One of the most exciting discoveries is the plasticity of the brain. Only a few years ago, we thought that its cell numbers and physiologic abilities were fixed by early childhood and could only decline with advancing age. Senility came to mean loss of memory and ability to think and reason. Senility doesn't mean that at all. It merely means growing older. Though IQ scores peak around age 17 and decline after age 40, and the brain cells are lost at a geometric rate after age 30, the mechanisms by which new data become memory still operate well in senescence. They merely operate less rapidly. In animals, adult brain tissue continues to grow. The area of a songbird's brain responsible for singing becomes measurably larger during the spring season for singing and smaller when it no longer has to attract a mate. The brain of a monkey trained to press a bar for a reward shows enlargement in the motor cortical area that controls the finger. In the last 2 years, we have now found a mechanism for encoding of memory. Short-term memory involves the energizing of existing protein molecules, but to transfer short-term to long-term memory requires the formation of new protein, which appears as varicosities or tiny bulges on the axons of brain nerve cells. Unfortunately, we know this to be true only for the snail's memory. But think of the potential. Nearly permanent warps in a personality could be absolved and years of therapy obviated for a victim of some major trauma, such as rape, by giving a protein synthetase inhibitor within hours of the trauma. We can now do the same thing with electroconvulsive treatment, which is painless and effectively eliminates very short-term memory. However, imagine the headlines in the National Enquirer: Cokeville school children victimized by mad bomber, then shocked by sadistic psychiatrist. New research involves parts of transplants of parts of fetal brains to brains damaged by Parkinson's disease in Huntington's, Korea. As the technique is refined and applied to other impairments, one wonders if we will find we are transplanting personality traits as well as brain apparatus. Correlating findings of brain function with extremes of behavior is a way eventually to decipher brain activity and more subtle behavior that constitutes personality style. Much of the behavior associated with major mental illness is extreme. Therefore, as an example of the effect of biology on behavior, let's consider the prototype of major mental illness, schizophrenia. Commonly thought of mistakenly as split personality. Schizophrenia is best thought of as fragmented mind. It connotes the failure to integrate the various parts and functions of the mind, thoughts with feelings, with perceptions, with memory, with values, and so forth. It's a major break with reality where the usual laws of logic do not apply, like living in a horrid dream. For a schizophrenic, this quasi-dreaming state may occur any time or all of the time, and it's a miserable state to live in. Ideas of causality of schizophrenia have evolved through the centuries, from supernatural forces of the universe to circulating body humors to demonic possession to animal magnetism to autoeroticism to unconscious drives to deficient ego boundaries to cruel and unusual mothers to the double bind to social impoverishment to viruses. Now we're back to circulating body humors, the chemical messengers we call neurotransmitters, which transfer messages between nerve fibers of the brain cells. The frontal lobes do not function adequately in schizophrenia. The deficient frontal lobe activity may cause the absent symptoms of schizophrenia, such as isolation and lack of social propriety. To drive the prefrontal area harder, another part of the brain sends an excess of neurotransmitters. It may be this excess that causes the active symptoms, such as hallucinations. Control the active symptoms with medication and get rid of the hallucinations. We cannot do
absence symptoms. Thus, schizophrenia is biologically based. It's also primarily hereditary. How do we know whether things are hereditary? Well, we notice that some things run in families. However, not everything that runs in families is hereditary. In Beijing, there is a high concordance within families for speaking Chinese. This strongly familial trait may not be inherited. And not everything that's inherited is genetic. Wealth and poverty run in families and are inherited, but not through the genes. Thus, traits running in families may still be due to the particular style of that family's nurturing. Adoption studies are a nearly ideal biological experiment because children adopted away in infancy have two sets of parents, those who provide the genes and those who nurture. Adopted away identical twins, having exactly the same set of genes coming from the same fertilized egg, provide an even more nearly ideal experiment. Any difference between them should be due to environment alone. What do such experiments show in schizophrenia? Children of one schizophrenic parent adopted away in infancy have a 10% chance of becoming schizophrenic, or a 50% chance should they have the incredible misfortune of birth to two schizophrenic parents. Both are the same percentages as had they stayed home. Children adopted to parents who later become schizophrenic have only a 1% risk, the same as if they had stayed home, and the same as the general population. They do have a high incidence, though, of such comments as, "You wouldn't believe the crazy family I came from." If one identical twin is schizophrenic, his sibling has a 70% risk of the same, no matter who raises him. Thus, heredity is the prime cause. However, why not 100% concordance if the genes are identical? Well, if we include schizotypal personality, a condition with symptoms similar to schizophrenia without the overt illness, the concordance rate is 80 to 90%. Where is the free will in schizophrenia? An afflicted person has choice, but the choice of appropriate reactions to one's neighbor is probably limited if all evidence points to his neighbor's KGB affiliation and his intent to brainwash one's children through invisible energy waves from the electrical outlets of one's home. We're inclined to excuse the behavior a schizophrenic may choose in these circumstances because he is psychotic, unless he imposes the behavior on us or runs afoul of the law. Then our tolerance narrows. How do we judge someone, for example, who is so irrational and thought as to believe that the way to engender romantic love in a movie star is to shoot the president? Is there an insanity defense before God? And if so, does the schizotypal brother of the schizophrenic qualify for it? Bipolar, or manic depressive disorder, is characterized by intense highs and lows in mood and aberrations in thoughts. During a manic episode, one is excitable, insomniac, euphoric, grandiose, often delusional, with incessant speech like I'm doing now, racing thoughts, flight of ideas, proneness to spending, hyperactive, hypersexual, often hyperreligious, easily angered, perhaps paranoid, with very bad judgment, everything the Amish ought not to be. The Amish community in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, became the subject of a study of heritability of bipolar disorder, not merely because anyone in a manic state would be so strikingly out of place among them, but also because the complicating factors such as alcoholism and questionable paternity are so low, the genealogy records of these large families are excellent, and the gene pool is almost closed. All 14,000 descended from the same 20 to 30 couples with virtually no outside intermarriage. The genes responsible have been localized to the tip of the short arm of chromosome 11. If we can pinpoint the genes, we will be able to identify who is at high risk, and we hope just what chemistry the genes set in motion to cause this illness. But remember, genes don't cause behavior. Genes only make protein. How responsible do we hold my bipolar patient who one day last month bought 7 cars on his schoolteacher income? A variant called bipolar type 2 involves similar symptoms on the high side, but of lesser intensity. How responsible would we hold him if he bought just 1 car, a Corvette, with the mortgage money? Manic states engender creative ways of getting into trouble, and creativity in general. A recent study of 47 prominent British painters, novelists, playwrights, poets, and sculptors, all royal academicians, showed an incredibly high incidence of mood disorder. Among the poets, 20% had been hospitalized for mood disorder, and 50% had required medication for mania or depression. The whole group were 35 times more likely to seek help for mood disorders than the general public. Depression is so well known a disorder that I won't discuss it other than to say that 15% of women and 10% of men will have it sometime, 3 to 5% seriously enough to be virtually immobilized. Depression happens in a somewhat hereditary pattern, even in the best of families and in people who live their religion. Listen to this very religious person's depression. "Oh, wretched man that I am, Yea, my heart sorroweth because of my flesh. My soul grieveth because of mine iniquities. I am encompassed about because of the temptations and the sins which do so easily beset me. And when I desire to rejoice, my heart groaneth because of my sins. 2 Nephi, chapter 4. What of the 12% who will have less severe depressions, but still the dysphoria, the inertia, the negativism, and the inability to enjoy? How do we judge the fruits of someone for whom getting out of bed in the morning seems like the supreme effort of his life? But again, these are extremes. What of the remaining 80% who probably won't develop a psychiatric disorder? We develop personality traits similar to, but less severe than, symptoms. Personality is the constant and characteristic way in which a person thinks, feels, acts, and perceives. In short, his habitual way of being in the world. The brain is the mediator of personality. The brain is immortal. Is the personality immortal? We have scriptural support for the idea that what is learned here will be retained in the hereafter. There is no reason to restrict that concept to factual information. What about the learning of how to be in the world, to the extent that that is learned? Some question exists as to whether such learning even endures in mortality, or whether our personality styles can be unlearned or relearned. If the personality by adulthood is no longer plastic, then psychotherapy is of little use, since the aim of therapy is change. But of far greater import, the same must be said for religion. If the good news of the gospel of Christ is that here is a way to change, and yet the personality is fixed and cannot change much, then religion would be for the already religious and the church a good old boys club. We talk of missionary work as the search for the blood of Israel. Israelites are those proselytes who don't need to change in any major way. They merely need to be discovered and reacquainted with the family. Anyone who truly needed major change would make a poor proselyte because the capacity to become someone different would be so limited. We recognize at the outset that personality, the subtleties that individualize us, is a product of a highly complex interaction of genetic makeup, experience of nurturing, learning, and environmental encounter. But let's consider the biologic basis of two representative personality styles that determine how we get along in the world. In everyone, there appears to be a biological mechanism that responds to social approval, applause, and admiration. This is usually obtained from parents in growing up, and later from peers by abandoning disapproved behaviors in favor of desirable ones. In some people, the mood control mechanism is faulty, creating excessive need for and emotional over-responsiveness to approval and to disapproval. We sometimes call these people applause addicts. Such people tend to be markedly moody, short-sighted, and often theatrical and seductive in an effort to elicit the needed approval. In this style, the boundaries between self and environment become blurred so that the external world becomes the regulator of self-esteem and well-being. Intense inner mood states are perceived as out of one's control. There may be tremendous effort to manipulate the environment in order to reestablish a sense of control over one's inner well-being and withdrawal into helplessness if these attempts are fruitless. Joyce told her psychiatrist of the wonderful relationship that had developed recently between her and Bob, her new boyfriend, who had so much in common with her and loved her so much that they were seriously thinking of marriage. At her next appointment, 2 weeks later, she reiterated that her relationship with her boyfriend was so wonderful that they had decided to marry. The psychiatrist replied, "I hope you and Bob will be very happy." Joyce's reply was, "Bob? Oh, I dumped him 10 days ago. I'm talking about Darren. Biological markers which identify these people include changes in brainwave patterns in sleep, changes in skin electrical conductivity suggesting instability of the autonomic nervous system, and hormonal tests pointing to neurotransmitter chemical deficiency. Neurotransmitting chemicals stimulate positive feeling and provide an internal sense of reward. The rapid breakdown of transmitters removes the reward when disapproval is encountered, provoking anger or despair. This excessively active chemical reward punishment system could be mollified by blocking the breakdown of these chemicals, and this is the mode of action of the antidepressant that is most effective in this emotional style. How free to choose behavior is a person whose sense of will of well-being is so heavily tied up in approval seeking that it must be had, no matter the price, to avoid intense demoralization. A different form of instability is anxiety proneness. Fear without an identifiable object to be afraid of, the very unpleasant sense that something is about to happen. It underlies simple phobias, social phobia, agoraphobia, school phobia, avoidant personality, and performance anxiety in everyday experience. For example, the fear of a job interview, of speaking up in Sunday school, of attempting to tell a joke at a party, of learning to ride a bicycle, or calling a girl for a date. Why are these experiences so easily mastered by some people and sheer agony for others? Again, let's examine the brain. Investigators of pain mechanisms discovered brain receptors to which morphine molecules attached themselves, generating pain-blocking messages. Puzzled over why a brain was made to receive molecules from the excrescences of flowers that grow in the mountains of Turkey and Burma, they postulated that maybe these receptors were created for molecules already in the brain, the brain's own morphine. They found such a substance and named it endogenous morphine-like substance, or endorphin. If the brain makes its own morphine, does it also make its own Valium? Could, and it does. A neurotransmitter substance called GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid, has a calming effect on the brain. Valium and related medications, instead of tranquilizing the brain, stimulate the GABA receptors to reduce anxiety. GABA deficiency appears correlated with unusual levels of anxiety. Some people become sensitive enough to unsettling experience that eventually an external stimulus is no longer required to cause anxiety. Anxiety becomes spontaneous, random, and generalized. How free is an anxiety-ridden person to choose socially courageous, assertive behavior, to be valiant in promoting his beliefs, to stand up for truth and right, or any cause when his GABA system is deficient? Think for a moment of this list of people. John Belushi, the comic, athlete Jim McMahon, DNA researcher Francis Crick, aviator Amelia Earhart, adventurer Jacques Cousteau, bank robbers Bonnie and Clyde, and test pilot Chuck Yeager. What do they all have in common? The right stuff? No. Plenty of GABA? Maybe. But all appear to be sensation-seeking personalities, of which impulsivity and fearlessness are prime features. Boredom leads to sensation-seeking. People unusually susceptible to boredom have a need for constant variety to bring physiological comfort. This inhibition directs these thrill seekers to relieve tedium through excesses of sociality, sexuality, speed, and nonconformism. Society will always have people who can't live in a conventional way, from bohemians to beatniks to hippies. Sensation seeking may lead to a variety of outcomes. Artists, musicians, scientists, entertainers, entrepreneurs, politicians, and soldiers, and of course addicts and delinquents and criminals and violence-prone people. What leads to a creative or a destructive manifestation of this trait isn't known. One factor may be socioeconomic status. With money, you can boss businesses, beat quotas, play racquetball, hang glide, race cars, or leave town. Without money, you can rob businesses, beat acquaintances, run rackets, hang out, steal cars, or skip town. When fearless sensation seekers become politicians and generals, we have much to fear, for they may not fear war enough. The antisocial personality is typically a sensation seeker. This is a chronic maladaptive pattern in which the rights of others are consistently violated. It involves hyperactivity, extremes of self-centeredness, an attitude of entitlement, of exemption from society's rules, inability to empathize, inability to learn from mistakes, marching to one's own drum, substance abuse in many cases, and a propensity for trouble of all kinds. A major feature is lack of remorse or guilt. For that reason, antisocial personalities are often found in prisons. However, others may be found at the heads of corporations. Charm, in fact, is a common feature. What makes an antisocial or criminal personality is not clear and has been the subject of years of debate. What is known now is that among these people, a biological propensity for impulsiveness is very common. The basis for this is a low capacity for arousal of the brain's cortex and disinhibited motor responses to a variety of stimuli. These people are likely to act rather than reflect. They have brains so unarousable that they must seek excessive stimulation in order to feel much of anything. Wheelies on State Street aren't enough for Evel Knievel. He must jump his motorcycle over the Snake River Canyon. The need for extreme behavior makes people dangerous. We are told that dangerousness can't be predicted, but when 6% of young criminal offenders commit 50% of the crimes, including the most vicious crimes, there must be a way to predict. In fact, it's violence that we cannot predict. To say that a person labeled as dangerous was in fact not so, since he committed no violent act, is akin to saying a fully loaded gasoline tanker truck should not have been labeled dangerous because it did not explode. One key to dangerousness is peculiar spikes in the electroencephalographs of a high percentage of criminal offenders. Another study showed that 100% of 15 consecutive criminals admitted to death row in New York had serious head injuries as children. The psychiatrist at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C. concluded after 16 years of work with criminally mentally ill that there is a criminal personality characterized by thinking disorders having nothing to do with social status or mental illness. They describe the habitual criminal as a liar, a deceiver, with little capacity for love, friendship, or companionship, who can commit brutal acts without a twinge of conscience, yet continue to see himself as a good person. Crime seems committed by deliberate choice. These people rejected schools, parents, and responsible forces in society long before society rejected them. Rather than being victims, they were victimizers. For them, crime had the ultimate excitement. Thinking about it, talking about it, committing it, even getting caught and trying to figure out how to beat the rap is exciting. From a very early age, excitement by doing the forbidden has been the oxygen of their lives. Working diligently with these patients or inmates through conventional treatment methods for several years, teaching them not to fight, steal, or tread on fellow men, elicited such gratitude in the patients that they held a congratulatory party for their doctors. For supplies, they used items stolen from other inmates in the hospital. It has been suggested that the United States is a sensation-seeking nation, not bound by the rules of centuries of tradition, social castes, and slow and deliberate modes of thinking, therefore ripe for innovation, creativity, and risk-taking. A disproportionate share of the immigrants to this country must have been thrill-seeking people, discontent with the secure and conventional, instead adventurous, creative, valuing freedom above security, and not being confinable by the established order. This may also include a good share of converts to a new religion. Perhaps this is why we are told this land was choice above all other lands as the birthplace of a very non-traditional religion. This country had the right stuff. Much free will is involved when a person is born with a brain showing... How much free will is involved when a person is born with a brain showing low cortical arousal, for whom life is so dull that excessive behavior to the point of outrageousness is required to feel much at all? Motor disinhibition and low levels of suppressing brain chemicals such as serotonin further foster the outrageous behavior. Certainly, conforming to rules of society or principles of the gospel, an ordinary event for most of us, must be a monumental achievement for such a person. Part of the sensation-seeking of this age is expressed in sexuality, including the insistence on being sexually different if so disposed. Does this, too, have its biological basis? What determines a person's sex? We have all learned in biology class it's our chromosome constitution, two X's for female, X and Y for male. However, this leaves us unable to account for females with X and Y chromosomes and males with two X's, or for those born with ambiguous genitalia. It is, in fact, not the X and Y chromosomes that determine sex. Everyone is biologically female in the beginning. If certain primordial structures degenerate and others proliferate during fetal life, a female will become a male. A male is simply the girl with something extra. It's more difficult for nature to create a male than a female. Therefore, more can go wrong in the process, and males are subject to more sexual aberration than females. However, society tolerates less aberration in males. A female in this audience wearing pants is not of interest. What about a male wearing a dress? Chromosomes determine what fetal hormone shall be secreted. The fetal hormones determine what the reproductive system will be like. However, the fetal sex hormones also have a role in organizing the brain along the behavioral and sexual lines of female or male. When a child is born, the reaction of the parents and caregivers to the external appearance of maleness or femaleness largely will contribute to his sense of maleness or femaleness. Finally, in adolescence, pubertal hormones will be secreted, which create the full adult appearance and arousability of male or female. This is like a relay race, one developmental stage and structure passing the baton to the next one. Each must function properly in sequence for the final outcome to be correct. Of the many possible fumblings in the baton pass, I'll mention two. Females with adrenogenital syndrome don't metabolize the small amount of male sex hormone their adrenal glands make. The higher level of male hormone may masculinize them in utero. This can be surgically corrected after birth. However, the vast majority of such girls, raised like any other girl, become tomboyish in their mannerisms and interests. Boys with testicular feminizing syndrome have bodies insensitive to their own male hormone. Therefore, they appear anatomically as females. Since they can't ever be male, it's wise to raise them as females. Estrogen given during adolescence will complete the process, although they will be sterile as adults. The question arises, is homosexuality a learned preference or a conscious choice to be aroused by a same-sex partner? Or is this arousal biologically based? The answer is unknown. Research with mice shows two independent brain systems for sexual behavior in either sex, one for male behaviors and one for female behaviors. The activity of each depending on genetic, prenatal, environmental, and hormonal influences. Males may be masculinized in sexual behavior, feminized in mannerisms, or both. Females may be masculinized or defeminized or both. Both genetic males and genetic females have the potential for both masculine and feminine behavior traits, and traits for the opposite sex may be increased or decreased without necessarily impairing sexual behavior of the genetic sex. Depending on the amount of testosterone in the fetal environment, mice can become more effeminate males, fully capable of male sexual function, but with female behavior traits, or demasculinized males, incapable of male sexual behavior even in the later presence of testosterone. The converse can be done with females. We don't know if this applies to humans, but early effeminate behavior in male children is found in one study to be the best single indicator of later homosexuality. In the last 10 years, professional belief has been that children born with ambiguous genitals should be raised female regardless of chromosome structure if they cannot be completely masculinized, and that the choice must be made before 18 months when a person's sexual identity becomes fixed and permanent. This professional wisdom has recently been challenged by the report of a group of XY males who were born with female-appearing genitalia and given female sex assignment. Having been brought up as girls, these patients were puzzled in entering puberty, to say the least, when they developed normal male genitalia. They had begun to produce their own testosterone, to which their bodies were now sensitive. The amazing finding is that these females turned male had very little difficulty changing their identity appropriately. 15 of the 18 had married and had no difficulty in changing their sexual object choice. This was apparently due to androgen exposure of their brains in fetal life. Thus, it appears that a person's sexual orientation is strongly influenced by events prior to his emergence from the womb. How much freedom is there in developing sexual feeling toward an appropriate partner if one's exposure to fetal androgen was inadequate or inappropriate to one's genetic sex? Beyond the question of sexual morality, general morality and ethical behavior also appears very early in life, according to new studies, and seems to be strong or weak independent of the atmosphere of rearing. Moral or ethical behavior in children is correlated better with capacity to empathize than to identify fairness. The injunction, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old he will not depart from it, appears to be good advice, but of limited effectiveness. What conclusions can be drawn from this mountain of disparate information? First, this information, factual now, is likely not to be true. It will be replaced by more facts and different facts, none of which constitute proof. I'm indebted to my good friend Fred Buchanan for this quote, who is indebted to which British newspaper, Fred? I don't remember. Quoting a British archaeologist trying to unravel with new archaeological evidence the mystery of the Arthurian legend, "There isn't such a thing as proof. There is only the balance of probability of a pattern of coherence. If you arrange your bits and pieces of evidence in one particular way, they appear to be coherent. If you try to arrange them in another way, they appear incoherent. Truth means the most coherent pattern of the currently available bits of evidence." Second, we should be more excited by what has not been said than what has. Most of our focus has been on what is pathological, or at least doesn't work well. But what is implied is how incredible a human being is for what does work right, our genetic endowment from God. We are endowed by our Creator with inalienable rights far more than wrongs. How like an angel in our capacity to reflect, in our capacity to be aware of our own mortality. Third, it requires a view of others that may frighten. Adoption, for example, is like playing roulette, maybe even Russian roulette. But then, so is marriage. Think of Mark Hoffman's wife. Fourth, a certain brain and personality by God who has either elected us to grace or not. What if we recognize symptoms of a disorder in ourselves which is biologically based? Does this remove our option to do anything about it? No, it gives us more we can do about it. If seven rings are a remarkable similarity, our differences are awesome. To know that some of our selfhood is not malleable or trainable, contrary to Watson's thought, is enormously comforting to me, perhaps similar to Christ, who needed not that any man should teach him. Others' influence can never completely take our selfhood away. Much welcome news for the parents of teenagers running around with the wrong crowd. Fifth, we may have to be more charitable and less judgmental with our fellows. Behavior compatible with a temple recommend may be a tremendous accomplishment for one, and for another, nothing worthy of note. What is the impact on gospel doctrine? We've said nothing to detract from the concept that humans are eternal and that we are self-existent as individual entities. It is possible that our genetic endowment is the mechanism of transfer of our personality from spirit world to earthly existence. We've said nothing to detract from the godly potential of mankind and the concept that what is gained here continues. Earthly life remains a growth stage and a testing stage. We continue to have free agency, our highest gift. I define free agency as the right to choose. However, what changes is our free will,
I define free will as our ability to choose. This is substantially different from pre-modern understanding that humans had animal needs and a spiritual nature endowed by God, which gave us the capacity to choose between right and wrong and good and bad. But if only 25% of our mental process is chosen, we still have 100% responsibility over that 25%. One psychiatrist's criticism is valid, and he gave this when the psychoanalytic idea of determinism was prominent. As one's fate formerly was determined by will, now it is determined by the repressed in mental life, or we would say, substitute by the wiring of the brain. Knowledgeable moderns put their backs to the couch, and we would substitute hand on the test tube, and in so doing may fail to put their shoulders to the wheel. As will has been devalued, so has courage, for courage can exist only in the service of will and can hardly be valued higher than that which it serves. In our understanding of human nature, we have gained determinism and lost determination. In sum, there is less free will than we ever thought, and far more than we can handle. Thank you.
Though Dr. Minch and I are dressed similarly today, I can assure you that we are not recently reunited twins. Dr. Minch has raised a very interesting issue, the matter of the freedom of the individual soul in the context of a natural world in which human beings participate surely has occupied a central place in Western philosophy and theology. The relative roles of one's upbringing and genetic inheritance, together with other more important factors, have preoccupied not a little of the literature. Unfortunately, little careful thinking has been done on the subject. Every side seems to have permitted dogma and doctrine to drive the gathering of data and the direction of the analysis. Dr. Minch makes several key and telling points. His suggestion that certain elements of ordinary human behavior are strongly influenced by biochemical events is almost certainly true. Many examples come to mind: the sexual drive of teenage boys, which too often overcomes wisdom and judgment, premenstrual stress in some women, and the varying ability of people to deal with everyday stress all point to the role that biochemistry, inherited or otherwise acquired, plays in the lives of healthy individuals. There is undoubtedly a wide continuum of freedom and moral responsibility as against necessity in the lives of normal human beings. To illuminate this point, Dr. Minch is correct when he observes that there are paradigm cases of genuine pathology, where some people are genuinely incapable of escaping the debilitating effects of their peculiar biochemistry. Examples of schizophrenia and manic depressives and a limited number of similar cases all quite clearly demonstrate that some unfortunate individuals are truly powerless in the face of an omnipotent, probably inherited, biochemistry. However, the consideration of such cases hardly exhausts the entire issue, and certainly does not provide much useful guidance when we talk about the vast majority of everyday actions, which certainly seem to be carried out by freely choosing individuals. Though Dr. Minch's paper sets out a blinding array of facts, it does not, in my judgment, sufficiently illuminate this topic. In reviewing his paper, and moreover the topic at large, I think that there are several areas of criticism which can be aimed at what I take to be the central thesis of the biogeneticists in general, namely that what appears to be freedom in human beings may be mere chimera. In my judgment, any one of the following objections would demonstrate as false the suggestion that genetic inheritance plays an operative role in the determination of significant life choices of non-pathological individuals. I will not deal today with the disastrous effects that a serious consideration of the biogenetic theory would have on the secular or sectarian world. Instead, I will confine my comments to the content of the biogenetic position, which can be demonstrated, in my view, to be incoherent and irrational without parading the horrors that might attend its adoption. First, the pathology of schizophrenia, manic depression, and other similar cases of biochemically stimulated disorders only applies to paradigm cases of illness, the causes of which may not be sensibly generalized to either the healthy individual in particular or the population in general. Because too much of the medical and psychological literature is long on facts and short on analysis, the proponents of the biochemical determinist theory often hastily generalize to the healthy population from the rather narrow range of cases with which those practitioners most commonly deal. Moreover, the biogenetic determinists often incorrectly extrapolate general theories of human behavior from the fact that rather convincing evidence suggests that there is a genetic component to non-behavioral illness, heart disease, for example. For the reason that not all persons are sick, the biochemical reasons for genuine mental illness do not and cannot provide any useful guidance when analyzing the actions of the broad spectrum of human behavior. The move to generalize from observations of paradigm cases of pathological mental illness to the general population at large is based on two assumptions. First, the belief that there is a continuum between ill and well persons. And two, that all human actions can be sufficiently explained by referring to antecedent biochemical events. It is more likely true that there is a rather sharp line of division between the schizophrenic and the ordinary healthy person, whose actions are not reducible to chemical analysis. Medical doctors are trained to see pathology in everyone. If psychiatrists and psychologists dealt with healthy people to make their living, the literature and the theories of human behavior, I suggest, would be markedly different. Number two, the biogenetic determinists too often use only a medical model of human behavior to account for the observable phenomena. The medical model is both tautological and reductionist by its insistence that virtually every human activity or mood in healthy and non-healthy individuals alike can be adequately accounted for by reference to the blind operation of chemical reactions. Of course, the use of a medical model reflects an a priori assumption of causes of human behavior for the reason that it is not logically possible to demonstrate that the creation of the Mona Lisa was merely the chance result of the dispassionate activity of the biochemical soup. In pursuing their medical model, the biogeneticists also tend to argue that the influence of psychoactive drugs in healthy individuals demonstrates that the choices of people are not really free. Of course, nothing of the sort is true. The biogenetic determinist theory is no more demonstrated by the somnambulant effect of Valium than a shackled person establishes that there is no freedom of movement without the chains. 3. Even the most enthusiastic proponents of the notion of biogenetic determinism, specifically the authors of the Minnesota monozygotic twin studies, freely and wisely infer only statistical probabilities of the population at large and not of individuals in particular, specifically healthy individuals. Though some biogeneticists wish to make more of the studies than the evidence would support, the best that the monozygotic twin studies can offer is that certain highly specific individuals may inherit tendencies toward highly individualized characteristics. Unless the biogeneticists can demonstrate that their data can lead to a statistically significant prediction of behavior in any given case, especially in the case of a paradigm healthy person, the theory is little more than a mildly interesting correlation study. And this raises another subtle issue. Because human language is largely teleological in nature, the ascendant descriptive model of human actions and aberrations in psychiatry is by definition addressed to and only considers antecedent causes for observed phenomena. To the extent that case studies and medical analysis focus on observable data and antecedent causation, they will probably not be able to provide much significant guidance in studying human behavior, for the reason that the premises permit only the conclusion that people are governed by antecedent chemical events. 4. The monozygotic twin studies do not deal with data much more significant than the remarkable presence of common toilet, ring-wearing, and fence construction habits among the studied individuals. Even the most seemingly remarkable similarities in those studies do not extend beyond common spouses' names or divorce habits, all of which are measured against the background of common names and a divorce rate run amok. Not one bit of data in any of the studies even purports to deal with those issues about which we would want to evaluate the highest expression of an individual's freedom. Politics, philosophy, socioeconomics, literary dispositions, and other like matters are nowhere discussed in the biogenetic determinist literature. Plainly, the twin studies, which are thought of so highly by the biogenetic theorists, are little more than a litany of insignificant similarities. 5. The biogenetic determinists cannot demonstrate empirically, and I suspect not logically either, that the much vaunted similarities in twins arose only from the operation of the chemical soup in which we all swim. It is one thing to argue that chemical events attend an action, and quite another to argue that chemical events cause an action. Human life is an enormously complex matter which cannot be adequately dealt with by the use of a single theory which posits only a narrow accounting for a dizzying array of data. 6. The biogenetic determinist cannot account for human ingenuity, creativity, art, acts of love or charity, or events of genius without engaging in the most crude sort of reductionist thinking, since these events cannot, by definition, be programmed, biochemically or otherwise. It follows that human activity must be, therefore, a sum greater than its parts. Therefore, there is a very strong suggestion that there is something inhabiting the mortal body which deliberates, which loves, acts, and reacts, and otherwise evidences will or a soul. 7. The biogenetic theory operates on an outmoded physical model of the world, never mind its singular preoccupation with a mechanistic medical view. The revelations of the new physics strongly suggest that nothing, from an electron to a human being, are blindly influenced or directed by, quote, outside forces. Rather, the thing observed and the entity observing the thing are seen to interact in complex and very profound ways. Quantum mechanics has demonstrated that the act of observation alters to some degree the nature of the world observed, thus denying any logical possibility of an infallible prediction of any future event. Other modern scientists candidly argue, for instance, that the reason there is oxygen is that there are oxygen-breathing creatures who need it, an interesting echo to Mormon cosmology. Therefore, the biogenetic insistence that human activity and behavior can be adequately accounted for by looking exclusively at antecedent chemical events neither fits the available evidence nor permits even the consideration that the will of individuals plays a dispositive role in the very nature of the world in which we live. No element of the world, from human behavior to the rush of wind, is entirely independent of the acts or choices of the creatures for whom this world was made. 8. The biogenetic behavior model, in my view, is logically absurd. Too often, every event counts as evidence for the theory such that nothing can conceivably be counter-evidence. If a person is moody, over-responsive, or evidence other conditions of unacceptable behavior, then Dr. Minch and other more insistent biogeneticists have a biological accounting for it. Shortened REM latency, abnormal dexamethasone, orthotropin, increased variability of galvanic skin responses, and a whole panoply of additional theorems if needed. And if these don't adequately account for a particular case, we always have the possibility of out-of-whack neurotransmitting chemicals, which allegedly generate positive feelings, the breakdown of which chemicals generates the anguish that people feel when they engage in obnoxious behavior. It may just as well be that neurotransmitting chemicals and electrical events are the result of the soul's action on the body. Since there is no evidence which would count against the biogenetic theory, it is unclear whether there is much logical or factual strength to it. And finally, many conditions that Dr. Minch and other psychiatrists describe as troublesome are more often the function of the value system of the evaluator rather than a faithful and defensible description of a genuine pathology. Dr. Minch's listing of shyness in a social setting or feeling uneasy when taking the LSAT or getting sweaty palms when facing screaming children in a sacrament meeting, set out as evidence of his theory, reveals little more than an a priori assumption that certain sorts of behavior are pro forma unacceptable. Too often, we all engage in a kind of behavioral authoritarianism. Namely, if the observed phenomena doesn't neatly fit into our predetermined and culturally specific view of social propriety, then it must be inappropriate. And once deemed so, such behavior must, of course, be caused by one or another chemical imbalance inherited from an afflicted ancestor. In sum, while the biogeneticists have contributed to our understanding of the way in which inherited factors might produce tendencies toward pathological events, they are unable, by definition, to sufficiently account for the wide range of observable human behavior, only a very small portion of which can be sensibly argued to evidence illness. Though Dr. Minch has correctly reminded us that some aspects of human life are largely influenced by biochemical factors, his theory fails to account for those significant cases that it must address in order to be a valid theory of human behavior. Biogenetic determinism, therefore, is no more than a variant of an old theorem dressed up in human rags, which fits the facts no better now than before. Thank you.
The clock says that it is time to end this session. I would like to be able to entertain just one question, if you can do it briefly, if that's all right. Does anyone just have one question? I'm sure you have a lot. I'm sorry about this. Yes.
I think that my old mentor, Dr. Appleby, would wince at that. The theory that I think Dr. Minch and others are arguing is really quite plain. That is that significant issues in human behavior are in fact influenced, if not directed, by biochemical events in a specific individual in question. It seems to me that from the Minnesota studies and others that I've read, not one of them, and I will reiterate, deal with significant life choices about which we would say evidence of the highest expression of a person's free will. I have admitted in my presentation that many things that we do are in fact influenced by these events. I do not deny that. However, you have missed the central point of my paper, and that's simply my response. And that simply is that on those issues where we would commonly seek to evaluate the highest expression of our freedom, the studies are silent.
And I'm sorry, that's all we have time for. If you would like to speak to them, maybe you can come forward. And don't forget, they do have tapes of these sessions, and a lot of them are already finished, and you can pick up copies at the Sunstone table. Thank you.